So we're going to continue to build and unionize and come together as one people and push for $15 an hour. And then when we get $15 an hour, we're going to continue to keep pushing, because we got to continue to keep pushing, because justice doesn't end with a $15 figure. Justice continues to go forth until everybody, everybody has the right to raise their family in dignity and hope and respect. Thank you so much.
Wake up, our America, time to pay your people well. They're the ones who care for you and work hard as hell. When will you see their value? Now's the time to show. Put your money where your mouth is and act like you know. Wake up, all the workers, time to come take a stand. I know we can do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds, and surely things will work out, cause they do it every time. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, just you and me.
Hi. My name's Sahara.
How do you feel about what's going on?
Like, some people out in the world, they don't have enough money like McDonald's. They want some more money. Like, for instance, they work hard, and people don't want to give them money. Like, their boss, they just want to sit and count the money. Fight for 15!
Yeah, welcome to the second hour of Can't Stop, Won't Stop, WPFW's year-end special on social activism here in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Avam, joined by fellow WPFW hosts Netfa Freeman and Jennifer Bryant. And staying with us is pediatrician and activist Margaret Flowers, activist Kevin Zeese. And joining us is Kelechi Egwin, executive director of Appeal. Appeal is a D.C.-based organization for economic and educational empowerment. And welcome, Kelechi.
Thank you very much.
So I know that you actually just got back in the country, so thanks for coming right over and being with us.
Yes, got a little bit of jet lag, but I'm happy to be here.
So we were talking in the first hour about cooperative economics and the ways that the Movement for Black Lives has linked physical violence, state violence, with what I call economic violence.
Right.
And so, from your vantage point, you know, where does the work that Appeal is doing, where does it fit into this discussion about economic empowerment, and particularly for African Americans?
Right. Our focus is on what we can do within our community to change the way we operate, to change our habits, the way we function. Not so much focus on the change of policy outside the community, but to fortify the community itself so that it doesn't need so much from policymakers and politicians, because that's really where the power is. People who have an interest in keeping you disempowered, if you will, are not going to be the ones who will be your ally to fortify you. Their purpose is to keep you needing them. And we recognize that. So we're building an institution, and we're supporting different collaboratives and networks to really create true economic empowerment within the community itself.
So earlier we were talking specifically about cooperatives, and I guess what are some of the ways that you incorporate kind of cooperative economics in your plans?
Right. We're actually launching a co-op as part of appeal on January 2nd of this year. Partnership with Freedom Paper Company.
Oh.
Freedom Paper Company is a black-owned operated manufacturer of personal care products, actually based out of Baltimore. And as part of that collaborative, we're bringing black producers and we have we're talking with black farmers to actually form a co-op. I mean, in other words, we do a lot of education, financial education. A lot of the problem that we see is really ignorance about just basic financial stuff, things that we really weren't educated about in the community. But in addition to all the educational stuff we do, and we have our think tank, and we are working on starting the credit union. But while all that's happening, we need to start to get in the habit of spending money with each other, and we're building networks of black-owned operated retailers to also help with that effort.
So a lot of people relate appeal to Lasana Mack and the effort to create a credit union. Can you tell us where that is in terms of development now?
Right, that's still in the planning stage. We are working on that. There needs to be a few more checks.
Done. Literal or
right? It's I think I'm not sure if we were too optimistic about the time frame that it would take, but it's a daunting effort. You know, there are so many things and so many things that work against such a effort succeeding. Mm-hmm. There's a sense of individualism that's a detriment. There's a sense of folks have tried so many times to achieve something, and you tell them we're going to do it this time, and they kind of have to sit back and wait. There's a lot of sit back and wait. There's a lot of folks that want you to build it and then they join. So we have we're dealing with those issues. But while that's happening, we are building. You know, we had probably about a 30% increase in membership last year as a membership organization, and you have to be a member to be part of a credit union. So we're building an organization so that the credit union can have the people and the funds to function. So when we're ready, we'll launch it. But that is definitely still going on, and our committee is working while all the other aspects of appeal are functioning. The planning committee for the credit union is also functioning.
Okay. So I wanted us also to touch on this hour on the U.S. presidential race, because income inequality, at least, is being brought up by one candidate, and issues of these very same issues that we're talking about are being discussed to some extent. And I wanted to know from anyone who wants to comment about how these movements that we're discussing are being impacted by the presidential race. How?
Or vice versa.
Yes. Okay.
Yes. Bernie Sanders had that field, and they get to meet with Black Lives Matter people on stage.
Right. Yeah. And I thought that maybe I would start with Margaret Flowers, who I mentioned in the last segment, was arrested last month after protesting the U.S. bombing of a Doctors Without Border hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan. But Margaret is also running for the U.S. Senate, you know, in Maryland. So I wanted to get your reaction in terms of how, as a candidate, how do you see What's your reaction to the race so far?
Right. Well, I think stepping back, I think NETFA touched on this in the first hour, is that we have to recognize that in the United States we have what's called a mirage democracy. We actually live in a plutocracy, which is ruled by the wealthy. And so the candidates that are running for president are largely vetted for us beforehand by Wall Street. I would say that Senator Sanders is somewhat of an exception to that. He is good on some domestic policy. He is willing to call out some of the corruption by the big banks. I think that, to me, what that represents is the fact that the various movements that have been so active over the last 4 years have really set those issues on the table. And so for the Democrats to have any kind of
credibility,
thank you, NETFA, they needed to have somebody that would speak to those issues. But we all know that the Democratic primary process is somewhat of a rigged process, and that it will be, you know, a pretty remarkable feat for Senator Sanders to actually win the nomination.
Somewhat rigged. I mean, there has not been an insurgent Democrat primary candidate that's won
under these rules.
Yeah, under these rules since the early 80s.
Right.
So they've successfully blocked every insurgent.
So for me, running, and I've been focused on movement building for a long time now, and people have asked me to run, I've always said no. The reason I'm running right now as a third party candidate seeking the Green Party nomination is that at some point we have to start to build, in addition to the alternative economic system, we have to have an alternative electoral system. And that takes time to build. And so by running, we're building that up in the state of Maryland. It's very exciting to me that we've drawn in a number of really great candidates at Baltimore City, which is really hot right now. And people get it, that the Democrats have been in power there since the 1940s, and we have some tremendous problems there with wealth inequality and mass incarceration, police abuse. I mean, you're aware of that. So drawing in more candidates who are willing to split with that party, who are willing to confront that party, who are willing to speak the truth about the issues, and we're working together to put in place a bold economic transformational agenda for Baltimore, that's really exciting. And I think that's, if we're going to do electoral work, we need to be focused on building what that outside piece is so that it can grow up. And so that's what I hope my campaign will help to do.
Anyone have any burning thoughts or comments on the election?
On the election in general?
Well, just, you know, the impact that you think it's having on some of these same movements that we've been talking about, or vice versa.
Mm. Well, I think vice versa is more the case. I think that the movement and how the movements that are happening on every front are forcing the candidates to have to speak to them. I mean, when has even the already elected officials talk about what I keep referring to as the academic of murders, extrajudicial killings by police. And it was just something that people weren't even talking about. And so now it's happening. I mean, I think that's what's having the effect, is vice versa. So mostly the candidate people on the, when it comes to the electoral process, I think maybe, the movements and the organizations adapt strategies and tactics because they know it's happening and they want to leverage how they can use that to their advantage. But on the other flip side, and the other side does the same thing, but they're having to respond to the growing movement and having to talk about issues they would normally rather avoid, I think.
Okay. And kind of bringing it full circle, it seems that, you know, Black Lives Matter has been successful to some extent in taking away some of the way that mainstream media always defines terror. Mm-hmm. You know, because people have been able to say, well, what we're experiencing in our communities, what we're experiencing right here is terror. And I don't know if you had any thoughts on that, Jennifer or Kalechi.
Well, just in listening, I think that the roots of Black Lives Matter was actually not activists or organizers. The roots of Black Lives Matter was working class people taking to the streets in Ferguson, refusing to go back in their homes when an injustice was committed in their community. And I think that the roots of any real change, any real move towards the end of police terrorism or income inequality, will come from those who are in the working class, those who are directly affected. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it's important for some of us to engage in electoral strategy. It won't be me, but other people mm-hmm. should. I think it's an important element. Mm-hmm. But I also think it's really important for us to figure out how do we take the palpable energy and just acknowledgement that our system is broken and it needs to change, that exists in the working class, and how do we form a working class led movement? Mm-hmm. One of the criticism of Black Lives Matter, or the movement for Black Lives, that I think is valid, is that a lot of times it's not led by people who are directly affected. And so I think that's just something that I'm thinking about as I listen, is how, in going into 2016, do we really make sure that the people who really started this whole thing are really at the front line, on the front lines next year?
I just want, because that made me think. I think also and this is my opinion about why that is, that what Jennifer just stated, is because a lot of it so much is focused on mobilization versus organization. Mobilizing people to do actions, to execute tactics, without it being part of a clear-cut strategy to reach a specific goal, particularly a goal that talks about systemic transformation. Right. And that's hard to, you know, to fathom. Right. But at the same time, we do have to do it so we're not spinning our wheels. And the organizational piece is more important in terms of protracted mass organization, political organization, because that's the only way we can leverage power when it comes to electoral, using the electoral process to our benefit. I think it's mostly to our benefit when, as like Appeals doing and other groups that are creating alternative systems for us to survive within this context, where that may fall short is on the statutory level, the kind of thing we can't manipulate the laws and whatnot. Sometimes those laws will hinder how far we can go with that, but then that's where we come in with the electoral process, when we actually can identify people who've been working among the grassroots, who we actually come from the grassroots and the movements, and we can say, this person has been doing this tremendous work, they've demonstrated themselves as a leader, we need to promote them. And then we also have a strong ideological base, a strong body of ideas, principles, and values that the individuals exemplify, that then we can promote them, and they're not somebody who just speaks well or anything, but actually has done the work, and then we can promote them and elect and run them, and there will be more sure that they're going to vote for policies and try to implement policies that will extend that process of us creating the world we want to see.
Right, and I like to say that the Black Lives Matter,
Kelechi.
The Black Lives Matter movement is talked about. Often it's talked about as if it's a new movement, as if it started in Ferguson. This is just it's another name for something we've seen. Brother Malcolm talked about Black power. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, this is all about the empowerment of the Black community in this country, and the unwillingness to really deal with the systemic racism that has existed since the first Black people were brought. The first 60 or so, I think they were brought to the, slaves, as enslaved Africans in this country. The continued systematic racism and unwillingness to deal with it. I mean, the Black Lives Matter movement is the Black Power movement. Mm-hmm. They don't call it Black Power movement, but the purpose if you read the 10-point program, it's the exact same thing. So we're acting like we're talking about a new thing. It's the same old thing. The problem is we haven't dealt with it systematically. Mm-hmm. You know, the discussion, I mean, I won't even get into the mainstream media, because I don't think any of them are taking the discussion seriously. When we talk about how do we affect this issue with police assassinating, murdering, you know, black men on the streets, black women in jail, nobody's even dealing with the fact that this country teaches a fear of black men. Mm. It's not they don't sit you in a class and say be afraid of black men, but every single aspect of society, both television, education, sports, symbolic and literal, mm-hmm. Teaches this systemic fear. And then you teach white men to be afraid of black men. And then you arm them and send them into the black community and say, serve and protect. You know, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that they're actually handicapped in doing that job. They function out of fear. Right. If you're going to see if a 12-year-old black boy is an adult to you and strikes fear in your heart, you don't need to be a police officer. Who's checking that? Mm. Where is that in the assessment of their mental capacity to function at their job? These are issues that we're not dealing with. Right. So we haven't started to have the serious discussion
we need to have about the systemic. You know, people confuse racism and prejudice. I don't care who likes who. The problem is, I don't really care.
The power.
Stokely Carmichael said that if a white man wants to lynch me, that's his problem. If he has the power to lynch me, that's my problem.
Right.
See what I'm saying? Yeah. See, so we haven't started having a real discussion. It's, I mean, definitely not in the mainstream media. You know, so, that's really where it is, dealing with the systemic racism that still exists. And, if you go back to the history of police officers, in this country, it goes back to snatching escaped Africans, you know, who got away from the plantations. That, I was reading an article about how, the Klan has been, recruiting, trying to get their members. They know that if a white man gets a job in the inner city as a police officer, he'll be able to affect the lives of black people. They can terrorize. And the connection between all these things are not being made. So when we talk about real change, this is where the real change is. Why aren't police officers required to live within a certain a mile radius of the community they serve? Why isn't the demographics of the police department as significant? We talk about demographics, every other aspect of things. Why is this? I mean, it's just a failure to recognize that there's a problem that exists before you even join the force, and nobody's looking at that problem.
Right. Well, in the case of the police officer in Tamir Rice's, I mean, he actually came from another department where he was declared incompetent and unable to handle a firearm.
Right.
And also I read online recently where the officer who brutalized Ajeria Becton in Texas, the sister who had on the bikini, he got a job with Joseph Arpaio, the kind of like
who,
like
racist sheriff.
Racist sheriff in Arizona.
Yeah.
So I had one caller this year, Jabari Zaki, a lot of people know him, activist in the community. He said, we need a database. You know, why are these people able to just go from one police force to the next? But that is one piece of it. And I wanted to, as we wind down this segment, ask people about how effective you feel these various movements that we're talking about are in making the links between the tremendous amount of our public funding that goes to the military.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I bring this up is because right now they're telling us ISIS is the only thing that matters. Right. And they're making this a point blank statement on every broadcast. You see, well, Americans only care about ISIS, so I don't know why you're talking about that other stuff.
Right. I thought you just talked about Trump.
And that just, it goes to the fact that we're in these protracted, endless wars, in the Middle East. I think the figure I saw was that 40% of every dollar that I give the federal government in my taxes goes to military spending. Some part of the military industrial complex, be that the NSA, the FBI, the CIA, Pentagon funding, how effective are our movements in making the connection between this violence at home, the state violence, and the violence that we're perpetuating around the world, which is blowing back at us.
Yes.
And then they want to tell us, well, see, this is the only thing that matters. I do know that for a while there was like a from Gaza to Ferguson type of connection, in terms of the people on the ground connected with each other also, but also in terms of talking about police officers getting training
in Israel. Right.
I know that was made at some point, but just in these larger issues, it seems like no one wants to talk. I did some work for a while with the labor movement, and you just never really find anyone willing to talk about it, to make that link and talk about the economic issues connected to the tremendous amount of our treasure that is going to militarism, fighting, and empire.
Mm-hmm. I think it's one of our biggest weaknesses as a movement. And I think it starts with hiding the truth. We don't talk about the United States as an empire. Mm-hmm. It's the largest empire in world history. We have over 1,100 military bases and outposts, 800 military bases. Rome and England at their peak had under 40 military bases, and we're 1,100. You know, it's insane. And so we spend 55% of our discretionary spending, you know, on the military, but we don't discuss it.
And oh, once
you
55. Realize it, okay.
You know, that's the discretionary spending. So that doesn't count Social Security. And but the empire part is important. Because empires are about economics. Right. You know, empire. We live in an empire economy. Now, who does an empire economy serve? And I think once you start to have that kind of discussion, that brings a lot of stuff out. Because, you know, the history of empires is also the history of slavery.
Colonialism.
What's that?
Colonialism.
Colonialism. You know, the history of colonialism is part of that. We're in a neo-colonial period. We're still dominating countries. But who gets wealthy from the empire? The transnational corporations get wealthy. The people of the United States get poorer. The oligarchs in the countries that are part of the empire, oligarchs get wealthier. The people in those areas don't. The environment gets ruined everywhere. And really, these trade agreements are also part of that, you know, as well. You know, I hate to say it, but the smartest comment I've heard in the presidential election this year about military spending has been Donald Trump. I couldn't believe someone sent it to me and gave me the site for it, and he laid it out. You know, we spent $5 trillion on these unnecessary wars that we shouldn't have been fighting. What would that $5 trillion have meant if we spent it in the United States? What would it have meant for energy transition, for infrastructure, for jobs, for wages? That's a lot of money, $5 trillion that we wasted on. We could have free college education for, you know, the whole generation.
Healthcare.
I mean, it's healthcare, I mean, everything. Housing. And so once you start thinking about empire, an empire economy, it changes the whole discussion about what our economy and what our economy is and who it serves.
I was able to attend the Spring Rising kind of anti-war protest outside the White House in, I think it was April.
It was April. Yeah.
And there were a lot of good speakers, but I spoke to a young man who was there, not one of the speakers, but just attending, and he was a writer, and I wanted to play his comments today.
Cool. It's important to be out here today because a war overseas targets black and brown lives, and as a person, I believe that our lives matter. And a war overseas is a war at home as well. So we can see how they are invading, how they invaded Iraq, or they're trying to invade Iran pretty soon. They bombed Libya and overthrew a leader there. They have reckless regard, the U.S. does, for how people are people, especially black and brown people. So that's why I'm out here, because you have to show solidarity with the movement overseas, with the people overseas who are fighting against the U.S. and its treacherous wars.
Yeah, so
He's right.
He was on point that day at Spring Rising here, right outside the White House. So, I want to thank my guests, Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeese and Kelechi Egwin for this segment. When we come back, Jennifer Netfer and Kelechi will stay with me, and we'll be joined by author and activist Gerald Horn, and in the next hour by Barbara Ehrenwine and some other folks to wrap up. But, right now we're gonna go to a break. Stay with us.
New Year's Eve starts early at WPFW, 8 a.m. to be exact. That's when our all-day-long end-of-year blues party begins. Thursday, December 31, it'll be blues morning and afternoon at 89.3. Steve Hoffman kicks off the end-of-year blues party at 8. Krista Property takes the helm at 11. Scooter Magruder keeps you bluesified at 2. And Dr. Nick serves up his blues remedies from 5 to 7. So whatever you're doing New Year's Eve, spend the day of that eve getting down in the alley, back into the roots, and deep into the heart of the blues. December 31 on WPFW, your station for jazz and justice. Don't forget the blues.
The Legalization of Possession of Minimal Amounts of Marijuana for Personal Use Act, also known as Initiative 71, makes it lawful to use marijuana if over the age of 21 in the District of Columbia. However, this initiative does not mean that there are no legal restrictions surrounding the use of marijuana. Know your rights and limitations. Weed out the myths. To learn more information about D.C.'s marijuana laws, visit thebluntruthsdc.com.
I am going back to stay in a place that is making me ill. Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. The pressures of life put a screw on my face. Afraid to recall what's going on in this place. Night and day in this town, somebody get gunned down. You ain't see crimes getting weary now. TNT, and you are gone. What else to do? We gone through like you want me recall for you. Every day on the hill, two or three does get killed. You were recalled that. You were recalled that. And that night on the ground, guns and drugs going down. You were recalled that. You were recalled that. And Archie and company telling me don't worry, things are rough. So you could stay here and play blind until I'm gone. Brazil, Brazil, Brazil.
Oh, welcome back to Can't Stop, Won't Stop, WPFW's live year-end special on social activism here in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam. My colleagues Jennifer Bryan and Netfer Freeman are staying with me to continue this discussion about the U.S. and the world and the world in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Our guest for this discussion is author and activist Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, the author of more than two dozen books. His most recent is Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. And his book about Paul Robeson is due out next month. Very busy man. Thanks for taking the time to be with us again, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, you know, we've been discussing Black Lives Matter, economic empowerment, and especially the TPP. But as we continue to look globally, I want to ask you your top issues, developments that's for 2015 that concern you globally?
Well, globally, on the one hand, you have this advance with regard to relations with Iran, the deal on civilian nuclear power. On the other hand, there's no doubt that the pro-Israel lobby and the neocons are hopping mad about this deal. In fact, if you look at the current issue of Foreign Affairs published by the Elite Council on Foreign Relations, Elliot Cohen, a former top advisor to George W. Bush and Mitt Romney, basically calls for what he terms, quote, political warfare, unquote, against Iran in 2016. That's going to be a hot issue that we will be unable to avoid. Likewise, I think a key issue for 2015 was the continuing rise of China on the one hand, and the problems in the Chinese economy on the other hand, which tended to lead to a slowdown in the economies of Brazil and Russia, and to a degree, Southern Africa as well, because commodity producing, that is to say, natural resource producing regions like Brazil and Southern Africa, were heavily dependent upon the Chinese economy, and when China started to slow down, their economy slowed down as well. That is also accompanied by increased tension between the United States and China, particularly in the South China Sea, where you've had military confrontations between the U.S. Navy and the Chinese Navy. We're going to have to keep a close eye on that issue in 2016.
I said in the last segment, actually, that the media is continuing to tell Americans that ISIS is the only thing that matters. You know, forget the economy, inequality, you know, your worker cooperative, you know, your concern over the TPP. And the narrative is that terrorism is the only thing that matters. And I'm wondering how you feel about the idea that 9/11 has been rebooted for 2015.
I think the problem is how that question is discussed. For example, we all know that religious zealotry is a direct outgrowth of U.S. intervention in Afghanistan in the 1980s, mm-hmm. that then got a shot of adrenaline when George W. Bush invaded Iraq in 2003, and got a further shot of adrenaline when the United States started interfering in the internal affairs of Syria, which led to the proclamation of the Iranian state on the Syria-Iraqi border. I think that it should be noted that the U.S. so-called ally in Saudi Arabia is probably the major funder of what is oftentimes referred to as terrorism. That hardly comes into view. not least because Saudi Arabia buys billions of dollars of arms from the U.S. military-industrial complex, not to mention the fact that Saudi investors are major players in Fox News, Apple Computer, and a number of other leading members of the Fortune 500 U.S. corporations. So the problem, I think, is how the question of so-called terrorism is framed.
You know, you mentioned Iran, and after the deal was completed, MoveOn sponsored a rally demonstration here to kind of celebrate that victory, because, you know, it was very touch and go there for a while. Netanyahu, I think, came all the way from Israel to, you know, without being invited by the president, actually, to try and pump up this deal to have it rejected. So I wanted to play one of the voices from someone talking about the Iran deal. He said that, you know, he felt like he was a survivor of 9/11.
Like many of us here today, I feel like a survivor of 9/11. I was in Manhattan on that fateful day. I heard the planes fly over. We smelt the sulfur for months afterwards. And I'm not sure what was more psychologically scarring. Those terrorist attacks or the way our nation responded to it. It seems like over the last 15 years, we've only known war.
So, yeah, that was one of the speakers at that event. Now, much of what is published about what's happening in Syria kind of seems Orwellian to me. Now we are fighting ISIS, which we helped create by our own invasions of Iraq and then Libya and the assassination of Gaddafi. And our so-called allies, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, are chief financiers of ISIS. And so it just seems like such a quagmire to me. And I'm wondering, is there a way out of this, or are we just kind of acting out like the kind of the Book of Revelations or something, and this is like our Armageddon?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. And I think the way out is not only true for these problematic global questions like ISIS, but also for domestic questions as well. For example, the police killings, which you were talking about in the last hour. That is to say that if you look at the lineup of forces in the United States of America right now, it's quite shocking. That is to say that the leading contenders for the GOP nomination, Donald J. Trump, Ben Carson, Carly Fiorina, have never held political office. I think that what the Republican Party electorate is telling us is that they want a true counter-revolution. And Governor Jeb Bush had his chance. Governor Rick Perry had his chance. Governor Scott Walker had his chance. They were not able to execute the counter-revolution. So they want some fresh blood who they think can push us all the way back, even beyond the Jim Crow years. It seems to me that one of the lessons of our history is that because the right wing in the United States historically has been so formidable, in order to be successful, we've had to lengthen the battlefield and reach out across the oceans and build up international alliances. That's the way, it seems to me, to fight back, not only domestically, but globally. But I'm afraid to say that oftentimes that has been one of the major weaknesses of our movement.
Mm-hmm. Netfa Freeman has a question for you.
Yeah, Doctor, how you doing?
Okay.
This is an ideological, philosophical question, if you will, because I think it seems, what do you think about the fact, how we view, particularly African people in the U.S., how we view ourselves in relationship to the colonizing, in relationship to imperialism and colonialism and these powers? It seems to me that it would make an incredible difference of how we, wouldn't it make an incredible difference on how we approach the movement, how we engage with the movement, if we didn't identify necessarily? So in other words, I identify with Gaddafi and the Libyan Jamahiriya before I identify with U.S. I don't think of in terms of, well, we did this to Gaddafi in Libya. I think, well, they did that to us. And so how would that affect how we engage with the incredible change that needs to take place in the world?
Well, I think it would have tremendous impact. I mean, it's no accident that Jim Crow began to crumble, coincidentally enough, as colonialism in Africa began to crumble. Because as colonialism in Africa began to crumble, the Africans were able to enter into international politics and put pressure on the United States, which at the time had to contend with the socialist camp in terms of trying to charged the socialist camp with human rights violations when the United States was one of the major human rights violators in the world with regard to Jim Crow. That dynamic led to the retreat of Jim Crow. If you look at the 19th century and the retreat of slavery, that had everything to do with the rise of Haitian revolutionaries and the rise of British abolitionism. Once again, one of the reasons we're sort of stuck in 2015 going on 2016 is that we've forgotten those very elementary lessons of history.
You know, in the last segment, Kalechi was talking about the inability for, I guess, movements or activists to deal with the issues of just the structural institutional racism and how ingrained it is in terms of the way police interact with our communities, kill our children, the way they view our children. And, you know, as I really think more about it, I don't really know if our movements are really set up to kind of make that kind of sea change in the way white people think. I don't know if that's something we can, like, even deal with right now. But I think that when I see people like Bernie Sanders, or I see people even on the local level here trying to speak to other white people, like white people talking to other white people about that, it seems to be more effective. I don't know if from your vantage point and the things that you, the literature you read and just the things that you observe, if you've seen any movements that are successful in kind of countering, you know, basically, you know, white privilege and kind of institutional racism.
Well, I think that's a point well taken. And I think it's particularly well taken when we consider that in the 2012 and 2014 elections nationally, about 60% of Euro-Americans voted for the Republican Party across class lines. And, of course, that kind of coalition is represented in the percentages now being racked up by Donald J. Trump, who is the presumptive nominee right now for the GOP nomination for president. I would make a couple of points in that regard. One, you recall that in the 1960s that we sent organizers door-to-door in Mississippi in black communities to try to educate people and register people to vote. We need the same kind of effort, I'm afraid, in white working class and white middle class communities, people going to door-to-door to educate these people. And secondly, in case they're oblivious and incorrigible and refuse to come around, we also need to be doing what people in Chicago have been doing, which is inviting the United Nations to send fact-finding delegations to investigate police torture, police abuse, to put more international pressure on the United States and the Organization of American States, headquartered in Washington, D.C., by the way, and the United Nations Human Rights Commission in Geneva, Switzerland, etc. Those are the kinds of strategies we need to pursue, it seems to me.
You know, I actually had a, we're actually working on that, but we have some SNCC veterans here in Washington, D.C. We're fortunate to have, veterans, elders here who worked in SNCC, and at least two of them have told me that there was actually a counterpart or within their organization of white activists who were supposed to go into the white communities and do these very same type of organizing and kind of education, but it never really got off the ground the way they wanted it to. And I do know that locally there are groups that are kind of organizing and meeting, and basically that's what their theme is. That's what their goal is. It's like white people talking to other white people about racism and privilege and those issues. So I wanted to, since we're talking about 2015 and we're trying to look at some international issues, I do know that I've heard periodically people talk about, in terms of Africa, and, you know, maybe we've discussed this before, but describe China as kind of like the new colonizer in Africa. And I know that you have a different take on that. I just wanted you to kind of talk about what you felt were the important developments in terms of China and Africa and perhaps just Africa in general that we might want to look out for next year.
Well, ironically, describing China as the new colonizer in some ways lets off the hook the old colonizers,
yeah,
by the way,
that's right,
are responsible for depositing millions of Africans in this continent and killing millions more in terms of the transatlantic slave trade. China will have a long way to go before it reaches such a despicable level. And in any case, it seems to me that Africans benefit when they have more than one door to knock on. Right. That is to say that if African nations, four dozen plus, are reduced to having to deal solely with the North Atlantic bloc and their ally in Japan, as opposed to having another door to knock on with regard to China, it seems to me that Africans prefer the latter, which is one of the reasons why a few weeks ago in Johannesburg, you saw heads of state and heads of government from African nations meeting with the Chinese leadership, which has led to an enormous amount, a number of deals between Beijing and these independent African nations. Likewise, a few weeks before that, you had independent African nations and their leadership meeting in New Delhi with another rising power, that is to say India. That is to say that I think we have to be very careful, because I recall that during the Cold War, when the Soviet Union was supporting liberation movements in Angola and Southern Africa, et cetera, I used to have debates with black people who were describing the Soviet Union as the new colonizer, yeah. who were saying that actually there was no conflict between Washington and Moscow. And, of course, the National Security Archive in Washington just released data that shows that the United States had nuclear missiles aimed at every population center in Russia at that time. And so we have to be very careful with our rhetoric, otherwise we'll wind up mimicking the rhetoric of our oppressors.
Right. Okay.
And I did want to say the...
Kelechi.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The conversation when it gets to referring to China as a new colonizer or exploiting Africa, it really lets off the hook African leaders, because the reason I was in Ghana a few weeks ago, I was in Nigeria about 3 days ago, and you look at the Kwame Nkrumah museum statue, and you look at the African Renaissance statue in Senegal. Wonderful projects built not by Africans, but by either Koreans or Chinese. Would you say, well, let's not build that? Let's not have it built, if it has to be done by Koreans or Chinese? Because the issue of not even being able to build roads without if you allocate $1 million for a road, only about maybe 10,000 or maybe 50,000 of that money goes to the actual road, and the rest of it goes to the empire of the structure of corruption that exists in these countries.
Right.
The reason why we need to have these allies. And that's what it, ally doesn't mean you relax. It doesn't mean that you stop building an alternative to it. But right now, we're simply not equipped to create the infrastructure we need to become independent of the Western nations. And China is just a better alternative. It doesn't mean that we rest there, but it is a better alternative. And people who don't want to give real analysis to the problem of African leaders not being accountable to their people. I mean, you've got folks, getting arrested, in airports with suitcases full of,
cash.
hundreds of millions of dollars of cash. And these are elected officials. Why is, that's the problem. The problem is that Africans still have not taken ownership of Africa. We still operate as if we are in a colonized, in various colonized nations. Nigerians, Ghanaians, we still operate as if we are still in a colonized nation. So when they steal from their own people, they don't perceive it as stealing from themselves. That the mentality of the neo-colonial leaders of Africa is the same as those who were put in place. When Patrice Lumumba, when Kwame Nkrumah, leaders that the people chose were taken out and certain leaders were put in, to ensure that Europe still got its piece of the pie. Mm-hmm. That mentality hasn't changed. And that's the problem. China is a patch, but it's not the problem. The problem is the leaders on the continent have not taken ownership And the people themselves have not even, they don't even believe that they should be holding their leaders accountable. It's as if, you know, the goal in West Africa in particular is not so much to end the corruption, you know, that bleeds the system, but it's how do I become part of the corruption? When people are graduating from college, from universities, you know, their goal is not how do we find a way to stop this problem. It's how do I join that system? So that's the issue right there. It's a very, very complex network of corruption that goes from top, it goes from the president all the way to the guy who's sweeping the streets, and that's the problem.
And you're from Nigeria.
Yeah, I'm from Nigeria. Yes.
Yeah.
And I would add, I definitely concur with that. And it actually mirrors the relationship of Africans in mass, the mass of Africans to the elected officials right here. And so it's really, there's a dilemma of how do we organize ourselves in such a way that people, elected officials, again, are people that are come from are fortified in our movements on the ground. I think it's a political issue, and it's actually mirrors the same thing. Neocolonialism is the order of the day for people of African descent right here in the United States as well. When it comes to having people who are elected and represent, you know, look like us, but don't really aren't encouraging, you know, aren't representing us. The in Africa after, you know, the independence movements, there weren't necessarily socialist revolutions or revolutions to overthrow the infrastructure. The models, the colonial models. So even a lot of constitutions and whatnot are formed after or modeled after the former colonizers. How, you know, and so in the Western world, or the imperialist powers were encouraging all these organizations and enforcing them, I mean, all these movements and enforcing them to adopt models like multi-party systems in the guise of this is more democratic and whatnot, when in fact there's nothing more democratic about having a whole bunch of parties. What it does is fracture on arbitrary political lines the people, when in fact they could be, when we see successful revolutions like in Cuba or whatever, one party states where people are actually forced to come together and work out their differences and organize on a mass. So this was a way to actually manipulate. They could pump money into certain parties and whatnot, and manipulate parties where it makes it difficult for the people to come together and organize to strengthen themselves.
Okay. Thank you, Netfer, for that. If you're just tuning in, I'm Esther Averam here with Jennifer Bryant, Netfer Freeman, and Kalechi Egwim of Appeal. And this is Can't Stop, Won't Stop, WPFW's year-end special on social justice activism. We've been speaking with author and activist Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. He's the author of more than 24 books, and his most recent is Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. And I think I mentioned that his book about Paul Robeson is due out next month. So I want you to stay tuned for our next and final hour, all about strategies for 2016. Gerald Horn will stay with us, and we'll be joined by attorney Barbara Arnwine. We're expecting her, and Tawanda Jones, sister of Tyrone West, who died after being beat, tasered, and beat very severely by the Baltimore police. Stay with us.